Probably some time ago I would have said that God blessed us with nice weather, but somewhere along the line I lost my attachment to what's nice and what's not nice, and as we were talking earlier, what's good and what's not good. And I think if it was raining today and we were right in the middle of our fifth season in Vermont, which is mud, I think I would have said God blessed us with a nice day today. So God blessed us with a nice sunny day today. Sometimes words can just really screw things up. The silence just makes so much more sense. Did anyone have trouble with the hour of silence during mealtime? Okay. Great. Great.
What I found in first experiencing that was my only difficulty with silence was I don't like being told what to do.
Did anyone notice a difference in the amount of food they ate as compared to when we don't eat in silence? Okay. Did anyone notice that maybe the food, I don't want to say taste it better, but taste it more? Does that make sense? Had more of a flavor to it? Yeah. Cool. I have something I'd like to read. How are the smokers doing this weekend? A lot of smokers in the room?
Yeah, smoking away.
Feeling healthy.
Any smokers in the room that would like to quit but are having a difficult time? A couple? Okay. Would you think it ridiculous if I said that there's a meditation for smoking? No.
I'm sure if we looked far enough, we'd probably find it.
This isn't too long. Smoking meditation. Because of this smoking... It helps if I start from the beginning. A man came to me. He had been suffering from chain smoking for 30 years. He was ill, and the doctor said, "You will never be healthy if you don't stop smoking." But he was a chronic smoker. He could not help it. He had tried. Not that he had not tried. He had tried hard, and he had suffered much in trying. But only for one day or 2 days, and then again the urge would come so tremendously it would simply take him away. Again, he would fall into the same pattern. Because of this smoking, he had lost all self-confidence. He knew he could not do a small thing. He could not stop smoking. He had become worthless in his own eyes. He thought himself just the most worthless person in the world. He had no respect for himself. He came to me. He said, "What can I do? How can I stop smoking?" I said, "Nobody can stop smoking. You have to understand. Smoking is not only a question of your decision now. It has entered into your world of habits. It has taken roots. 30 years is a long time. It has taken roots in your body, in your chemistry. It has spread all over. It is not a question of your head deciding. Your head cannot do anything. The head is impotent. It can start things, but it cannot stop them so easily. Once you have started and once you have practiced so long, you are a great yogi. 30 years of practicing smoking. It has become autonomous. You will have to de-automatize it." He said, "What do you mean by de-automatization?" And that's what meditation is all about, de-automatization. I said, "You do one thing. Forget about stopping. There is no need either. For 30 years, you have smoked and lived. Of course it was a suffering, but you have become accustomed to that. And what does it matter if you die a few years earlier than you would have died without smoking? What are you going to do here? What have you done? What is the point? Whether you die Monday or Tuesday or Sunday, this year, that year, what does it matter?" He says, "Yes, this is true. It doesn't matter." Then I said, Forget about it. We're not going to stop it at all. Rather, we're going to understand it. So next time, you make it a meditation. He said, meditation out of smoking? I said, yes. If Zen people can make a meditation out of drinking tea and can make it a ceremony, why not? Smoking can be as beautiful as a meditation. He looked thrilled. He said, what are you saying? He became alive. He said, meditation? Just tell me. I can't wait. I gave him the meditation. I said, do one thing. You are taking the packet of cigarettes out of your pocket. Move slowly. Enjoy it. There is no hurry. Be conscious, alert, aware. Take it out slowly with full awareness. Then take the cigarette out of the packet with full awareness, slowly. Not in the old hurried way, the unconscious way, mechanical way. Then start tapping the cigarette on your packet, but very alertly. Listen to the sound, just as Zen people do when the samovar starts singing and the tea starts boiling, and the aroma. Then smell the cigarette and the beauty of it. He said, what are you saying, the beauty? Yes, it is beautiful. I wish I could do the accent of this guru. That would be funnier than what I'm reading. Tobacco is, yes, it is beautiful. Tobacco is as divine as anything. Smell it. It is God's smell. He looked a little surprised. He said, what? Are you joking? No, I am not joking. Even when I joke, I don't joke. I am very serious. I sound more Jewish than I do Indian. Then put it in your mouth with full awareness. Light it. And with full awareness, enjoy every act, every smell, and divide it into as many acts as possible so you can become more and more aware. Then have the first puff. God in the form of smoke. Hindus say, Anan Brahm, food is God. Why not smoke? All is God. Fill your lungs deeply. This is a pranayam. I am giving you the new yoga for the new age. Then release the smoke. Relax. Another puff. And go very slowly. If you can do it, you will be surprised. Soon you will see the whole stupidity of it. And when he says stupidity, he says estupidity.
No, he doesn't.
No?
He says estupidity.
Not because others have said that is as stupid. Not because others have said that it is bad. You will see it. And the seeing will not just be intellectual. It will be from your total being. It will be a vision of your totality. And then one day, if it drops, it drops. If it continues, it continues. You need not worry about it. After 3 months, he came and he said, but it dropped. Now I said, try it on other things too. This is the secret. The secret. De-automatize. Walking, walk slowly, watchfully. Looking, look watchfully. And you will see trees are greener than they have ever been and roses are rosier than they have ever been. Listen. Somebody is talking, gossiping. Listen. Listen attentively. When you are talking, talk attentively. Let your whole waking activity become de-automatized. Here's some tips on meditation. The three essentials. Meditation has a few essential things in it, whatever the method, but those few essentials are necessary in every method. The first is a relaxed state, no fight with the mind, no control of the mind, no concentration. Second, just watch with a relaxed awareness whatever is going on without any interference, just watching the mind silently without any judgment, evaluation. These are the three things. Relaxation, watching, no judgment. and slowly, slowly, a great silence descends over you. All movement within you ceases. You are, but there is no sense of I am. Let me say that again. You are, but there is no sense of I am. Just the pure space. There are 112 methods of meditation. They differ in their constitution, but the fundamentals remain the same. Relaxation, watchfulness, non-judgmental attitude. First thing, be playful. Millions of people miss meditation because meditation has taken on a wrong connotation. It looks very serious, looks gloomy, has something of the church in it. It looks as if only for people who are dead or almost dead. Those who are gloomy, serious, have long faces, who have lost festivity, fun, playfulness, celebration. These are the qualities of meditation. A really meditative person is playful. Life is fun for him. Life is a play. He enjoys it tremendously. He is not serious. He is relaxed. Second thing, be patient. Don't be in a hurry. So often hurrying causes delay. As you thirst, wait patiently. The deeper the waiting, the sooner it comes. You have sown the seed. Now sit in the shade and watch what happens. The seed will break. It will blossom. But you cannot speed the process. Doesn't everything need time? Work you must, but leave the results to God. Nothing in life is ever wasted, especially steps taken towards the truth. But at times, impatience comes. Impatience comes with thirst, but this is an obstacle. Keep the thirst and throw the impatience. Do not confuse impatience with thirst. With thirst, there is a yearning, but no struggle. With impatience, there is a struggle, but no yearning. With longing, there is waiting, but no demanding. With impatience, there is demanding, but no waiting. With thirst, there are silent tears. With impatience, there is restless struggle. Truth cannot be rated. It is attained through surrender, not through struggle. It is conquered through total surrender. Don't look for results. The ego is result-oriented. The mind always hankers for results. The mind is never interested in the act itself. Its interest is in the result. What am I going to gain out of it? If the mind can manage to gain without going through any action, then it will choose the shortcut. That's why educated people become very cunning, because they are able to find shortcuts. If you earn money through a legal way, it may take your whole life. But if you can earn money through smuggling, by gambling, or by something else, by becoming a political leader, a prime minister, a president, then you have all the shortcuts available to you. The educated person becomes cunning. He does not become wise. He simply becomes clever. He becomes so cunning that he wants to have everything without doing anything for it. Meditation happens only to those who are not result-oriented. Meditation is a non-goal-oriented state. Last thing, appreciate unawareness. While aware, enjoy awareness. And while unaware, enjoy unawareness. Nothing is wrong, because unawareness is like a rest. Otherwise, awareness would become attention. If you are awake 24 hours, how many days do you think you can be alive? Without food, a man can live for 3 months. Without sleep, within 3 weeks, he will go mad, and he will try to commit suicide. In the day, you are alert. In the night, you are relaxed. And that relaxation helps you in the day be more alert, fresh again. Energies have passed through a rest period, so they are more alive in the morning again. The same will happen in meditation. For a few moments, you are perfectly aware. At the peak, and for a few moments, you are in the valley, resting. Awareness has disappeared. You have forgotten. But what is wrong in it? It is simple. Through unawareness, awareness will arise again, fresh, young, and this will go on. If you can enjoy both, you can become the third. And that is the point to be understood. If you can enjoy both, it means that you are neither awareness nor unawareness. You are the one who enjoys both. Something of the beyond enters. In fact, this is the real witness. happiness you enjoy. What is wrong with it? When happiness has gone and you have become sad, what is wrong with sadness? Enjoy it. Once you have become capable of enjoying sadness, then you are neither. And this I tell you, if you enjoy sadness, it has its own beauties. Happiness is a little shallow. Sadness is very deep. It has a depth to it. A man who has never been sad will be shallow, just on the surface. Sadness is like a dark night, very deep. Darkness has a silence to it, and sadness also. Happiness bubbles. There is a sound in it. It is like a river in the mountains. Sound is created. But in the mountains, a river can never be very deep. It is always shallow. When the river comes to the plain, it becomes deep, but the sound stops. It moves as if not moving. Sadness has depth. Why create trouble? While happy, be happy. Enjoy it. Don't get identified with it. When I say be happy, I mean enjoy it. Let it be a climax which will move and change. The morning changes into noon. Noon changes into evening. And then comes night. Let happiness be a climate around you. Enjoy it. And then when sadness comes, enjoy that too. I teach you enjoyment whatsoever is the case. Sit silently and enjoy sadness. And suddenly sadness is no longer sadness. It has become a silent, peaceful moment, beautiful in itself. Nothing is wrong in it. And then comes the ultimate alchemy, the point where suddenly you realize that you are neither happiness or sadness. You are the watcher. You watch peaks, you watch valleys, but you are neither. Once this point is attained, you can go on celebrating everything. You celebrate life, you celebrate death.
Hi. I actually got the idea before to close with the Mickey Mouse song. You know, now it's time to say goodbye, but that'll be tomorrow. Sometimes when I share my story, I say something that it's for shock value, I say it. And what the expression is that the goal of the steps is not recovery from alcoholism. And then I pause and let everybody take that in and disagree with it completely. And then I'll say the beginning of the 12 steps states what the goal of the steps are, to awaken spiritually. Last year, a book came out by Wayne Dyer that was called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. That's starting to be my experience. I don't see it as a drinking problem. I see it as a spiritual problem. I don't see it as a spending problem. I see it as a spiritual problem. I don't see it as a relationship problem. I see it as a spiritual problem. I don't see it as a problem with my boss. I see it as a spiritual problem. And in how it works, Bill even agrees with that, because he says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And this weekend we've been talking a lot about meditation and prayer and all kinds of spiritual stuff, and the obvious question is, why so much importance on that? And a question that you might want to ask yourself is, you know, first of all, do you agree that a spiritual way of life is necessary for true contentment? But on top of that, if you agree with that statement, you also need to ask yourself, what are you doing to grow spiritually? What does it mean to grow spiritually? How do you know that you've grown spiritually? You know, everybody talks about, you know, it's important to grow spiritually. How do you know if you've grown spiritually? Part of the packet has a whole bunch of inventories that are tests to see how are we doing spiritually. There's ways to see, how am I doing spiritually? You know, what is your inner condition and peace during your home group's business meeting? How do you act in traffic when you're late and you got to deal with crazy drivers in traffic? You don't necessarily have to do it, but just imagine if you had to spend a week with your parents.
I could have swore I just heard someone say, what an order, I can't go through with it.
For me, these are ways to tell how I'm doing spiritually. You know, it's real good when things are going well to say that I'm doing real well spiritually, when push comes to shove. You know, there's an expression that says that, you know, when you squeeze a piece of fruit, juice comes out. And when we get squeezed by our life, whatever comes out is what's inside of us. We can kind of seem good and act good and sound good and think that we're doing well, but then when we get squeezed, you know, what comes out is what is still inside of us, and that perhaps is showing us what we need to look at. And for me, if the goal of the steps is to awaken spiritually, again, am I making growing spiritually a priority? I can't tell you how many conversations I've had this weekend and prior to it of, you know, a show me, don't tell me kind of conversations. And am I making stuff like this a priority? Something that's interesting with the 10th and 11th step is it constantly talks about those two parts within us. It's sometimes depicted on TV as the angel and the devil on our shoulder. That there's these two parts within us. One I would like to call the ego, the other one I would like to call God. That is the constant struggle of all of life for everyone. Which voice are we listening to at any one moment when we're about to do something? And there's a really cool, there's actually two ways that I've seen it put. I sometimes describe it as two dogs. I've seen the story of the two wolves. These are the two stories that kind of describe it. It says, a battle of fearless forces rage within me. One side is an eagle, which carries me soaring above the valleys of my soul in search for truth on wisdom's peaks. The other side is a raging wolf. It tears apart my broken wings and drags me to the depths of self-defeat. Which one succeeds? The one I feed. And then the other way that's put is a Native American expression. It says, an old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside me, he says to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it's between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, fears, lies, soft pride, or false pride.
Soft pride?
False pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. This same fight is going on inside of you, inside of every person, too. The grandson thought about it for a minute, and then he asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. I know when I was out there, I could do some pretty evil stuff, and my conscience didn't really come against me that harshly, and when it did, I just kind of disregarded it. Because at that time, I was feeding the negative aspect of me. I was feeding the unhealthy voice. The healthy voice was still there. The good that was in me was still there, but it was smaller and smaller as time went by. I don't believe that either one of them ever dies. But today, sometimes I could do some small little thing that I know was wrong, and my conscience just ripped me apart. You know, and I see it as a good thing now. It's sort of an inner barometer. I used to hate that sense of knowing that I did something wrong. But today, I think, because the more we make doing the right thing a priority, the stronger that voice gets, you know, because we're feeding it. And the weaker the other one gets because we're not feeding it. And I'd like to do a little exercise with you. It's a little 10-second exercise. It's the silliest, stupidest little thing. But it's been mind-blowing when I experienced it, and it's been mind-blowing in passing it along to people, because sometimes we just don't know what's going on inside of us. You know, it was once said that, you know, we have a grand central station mind, but we don't have to get on every train that comes through the station. That we just think that our mind is just, you know, our just mind just gets us to do things and runs the show, and the chatter of a million monkeys is going on, and there's this craziness going on inside of us, but we also have this healthy aspect within inside of us. And as time goes by, for me, it's becoming better and easier to distinguish between which voice is speaking at any one moment. Mike had mentioned earlier that, you know, in the beginning, whichever one came first was the one that you could pretty much just disregard. Today, it's not always that way. As a matter of fact, it's not often that way. It's not mostly that way anymore. And that's a real freedom. That's a real beauty. And This is the 10-second exercise. If you don't mind, again, just close your eyes. It'll just be for 10 seconds. You don't have to get comfortable or anything. It's just 10 seconds. It's not a meditation or anything like that. But in the next 10 seconds, I'd like you to do one thing. Please observe your thoughts. Now, what's strange about that exercise is, first of all, usually no thoughts come. The reason is because the ego doesn't want to draw attention to itself. It just wants to run the show without you knowing it. It just wants to tell you what to do and see if you'll follow along. Now, the other thing that's interesting about that exercise is something outside of your mind was observing your mind. There's these two consciousness that are going on inside of us that kind of run parallel. Like I said, one I would call ego and the other one I would call God or conscience or whatever you want to call it. And it's always there. And what's also interesting about that exercise is in the moment that you're observing your thoughts, you're totally in the moment. So your mind always wants to be in the past and your mind always wants to be in the future. So when you're in the moment, the mind just all of a sudden just freaks and, you know, just can't deal with that and just kind of shuts off because you're trying to be in the moment and it doesn't want to be in the moment. It wants to draw attention, you know, don't look here, you know, it wants to run the show without us realizing it. And it's funny because the 10th step talks about it in detail. What you'll notice as part of the 10th step is that we had touched upon it already. It talks about, as part of the 11th step, it talks about it says, when considering our plans for the day, before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that he be divorced from self-pity, dishonesty, or self-seeking motives. Then it says, our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when my thinking is cleared of wrong motives. It's talking about, let me tap into that part within me that is my conscience, that part within me that is the healthy voice. You'll also notice in 10 and 11 how often it talks about our inner state and our inner condition. In the 11th step, it talks about, on the top of 86, it talks about having the proper attitude. It talks about constructively reviewing our day. We do that on the inside. It talks about were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others. It talks about after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken, all on the inside. It talks about considering our plans for the day. It talks about asking God to direct our thinking, that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. It talks about our mental faculties. It talks about our brains. It talks about wrong motives. It talks about our thought life. It talks about facing indecision, determining which course to take, inspiration, thought, decision. The right answer will come. The hunch and the occasional inspiration, the mind, having conscious contact with God, being inspired, having ideas, thinking, inspiration. 10 and 11 is totally focused on our inner condition. Anthony DeMello said once that it's a whole lot easier to put on slippers than it is to carpet the whole world. We always want to change everybody else and everything that's going on around us instead of wanting to change ourselves and what's going on the inside of us to get a different perspective toward it. And for me, it's brought a lot of freedom in realizing that I am not my thinking. We've all experienced our mind telling us to do something that we know was wrong and didn't do it. We don't have to do what our mind tells us to do. There's another consciousness within us. There's another aspect of our being in consciousness, that's the healthy voice. And we had said earlier about the four absolutes, that a good way to tell whether I'm about to do what I think is God's will or about to do the right thing is it honest? You know, would I be ashamed to tell everybody what I'm about to do? Would I be ashamed to tell everybody what I'm doing? If what I'm doing is displayed on a screen for all to see, how would I respond to that? If I wouldn't want people to see it, there's probably a good chance that I know deep down that I shouldn't be doing this. It's kind of interesting because for me that was really powerful. For me, a year and a half ago, I went through the breakup of a marriage and my heart was ripped and my head started chewing me up and spitting me out because I started thinking about the things that I wish I hadn't done that I did, and I started thinking about the things that I didn't do that I wish I had. And I started thinking about what if and if this was different, and for 8 months, I ripped my soul apart because of my mind chewing me up and spitting me out. And it's funny because a bunch of my friends I talked to so often, and I just couldn't get off of it. I couldn't get off of it because I truly love this woman, and I just couldn't understand what was wrong you know, I got to fix it. This doesn't make sense. It does, you know, whenever I add up all the parts, it never equates to the relationship is over. We had a good relationship, and all of a sudden, one of my friends said to me, which is interesting because I think basically he got it from me, which, to be honest with you, is the beauty of working with people and having close friends, because eventually they spit at you what you spit at them. And it's very helpful because sometimes we just don't think on those levels when we're involved. You know what I mean? We have such wonderful wisdom for other people. We have such wonderful wisdom when we're not involved. And what he said to me was, you know, Bill, when these thoughts come, just say, no, I'm not willing to follow that train of thought. And what was interesting was my biggest problem was in meditation, because that was when the mind started. That was when the mind would attack me, literally. And finally, I just said, you know, this is all kind of entertaining, but I'm not willing to follow this train of thought. I don't agree. I'm not willing to agree with this. I'm not willing to look at this anymore. I've hyper-analyzed this to the point of unhealthiness, and I'm just not willing to go there anymore. And all of a sudden, the thought would just disappear like it was never even there anyway. You know what I mean? Just all of a sudden, it would just disappear. And it's strange to be talking to yourself on that level because, you know, it's this alive thing within us. You know, it's coming back and powerful whether we're drinking or not. This part of within us that's the unhealthy voice. And it was, for me, just another example of the truth of that we could always tap into that other part within us. And we could always see that, you know, sometimes we'll just go back and forth, and that a couple of my friends started saying to me, Bill, you just get on another train. Just get off. You got on another train. Another thought went by, and you agreed with it and went for a ride. You can just as easily get off that train because it's not working for you anymore. And it was just so beautiful in my experience and in seeing again that there's so much truth to this spiritual stuff that people talk about when it's applied and when it's used as a way of life inside of us, that we can all relate to that good dog, bad dog, good voice, bad voice aspect. And for me, having conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves is when we tap into that healthy voice, that comfortable, calm, all-knowing, safe, protected, I know that I'm going to be okay. Whether it looks like it or not, whether it feels like it or not, whether I agree with it or not, there's this part within me that's going to be that knows that everything is okay. And like with talking about the love thing before, that in seeing that I'm not my thinking and that I can get off the train anytime that I want to, there was a real freedom and there was a real tool to deal with life, because for so long, you know, I just really thought that my thinking was just, you know, I have no choice. I just have to do what this voice is telling me to do. And, you know, it's just so, for me, reassuring that there's this other aspect within us. And sometimes somebody else can point it out to me, and sometimes I can tap into it and know it's there, but it is always there in my experience.
Does that mean I'm supposed to do something next?
We could just ring this bell for a half hour. That would be fun. I think I'd like to talk about an exercise that brought me to the next level, although I don't believe that there's any levels in spiritual living. But for lack of a better way to say it, brought me to the next level in spiritual living. I call it I am not my body, I'm not my mind, I'm not my emotions exercise, whatever you want to call it. Bill touched a lot on the mind and how we're not the mind, so I'm not going to have to go there very much. So if we're not our minds, what about our bodies? And when I say, what am I? I mean, when all is said and done, spiritually, in the fourth dimension of existence, in the world of the spirit, what have I always been and what will I always be? And what am I this very moment? So, if we were to This is violent. If we were to chop off your arms, would you still be you? If we were to amputate your legs, would you still be you? If we were to remove all your internal organs and replace them with new ones, would you still be you? If a type of accident happened where you no longer had any short-term memory, or any long-term memory for that matter, would you still be you? Have you ever gone through periods of deep emotional pain, maybe sadness, maybe mourning, maybe grief? But yet when you got quiet and got still, you had this sense deep down within everything was going to be all right. Amongst that sadness, amongst that turmoil, call it the dark night of the soul, if you will, were you still you? What are you now, this very moment? What were you 5 years ago? What were you 5 years before that? What were you in high school? Grammar school. Kindergarten. Preschool. What were you when you were an infant? What were you before you were born to this earth, when you were still inside your mother's womb? What were you when you were a fetus? What were you when you were just conceived? What were you before that? And before that? And before that? What are you now, this very moment, right here, right now? Has anything changed spiritually in the fourth dimension, world of the spirit? Over the years, I've used a lot of different words for this thing we call God. The big book's real neat because it uses a whole lot of different descriptions for God. Great reality deep within. whole bunch of different things. Truth, higher power. Bill always says power with a capital P. First time I ever got in touch with this part of me, and I do believe it is a part of me. I don't believe it's anything externally that I have to go out and get. Here's a question to ask yourself. Is it possible that everything you've ever needed, everything you currently need right here, right now, and everything you'll ever, ever need, you have already? You've always had it, and you'll always have it. I first began to get in touch with this thing we call truth, this thing we call God, when I was writing my first inventory. Actually, it was probably my second inventory. Because my first four-step was nothing more than a shabby three-column inventory. You know, and it really didn't point the finger much at me. I got to look a little bit at that in my first fifth step. But when I went through the steps for the second time, I really got in touch with some truth. For those who have written inventory, have you ever been writing the fourth column and for a while it seems like it's all up here? Like the stuff that you're putting down on paper, I'm selfish, I'm dishonest, I'm self-seeking, I'm frightened, and it's almost like you have to think about it and conjure it up in your mind before it gets put on the paper. And then all of a sudden, from left field, bam, just something shoots out of your pen and you have no idea where it came from, and it's right on the paper. And it has absolutely nothing to do with my mind. Because we begin to tap into another place. So I began to see that I really believe that our book talks about four dimensions to us. The physical dimension, the mental dimension, the emotional dimension, and the spiritual dimension, which I like to call, or the book calls, the world of the spirit. And it was probably a couple years ago that I saw that everything I have in that inventory is everything I need, not only for the rest of the steps, but for the rest of my life. Because it gives me all four dimensions. In the first column of inventory, and I'm talking specifically about resentment inventory, I get to write about who I'm mad at. Who am I resentful at? Who ticks me off? That who is usually a physical entity, whether it be a person, place, an institution, principle. Principles aren't really physical, but institutions and people are. And I saw that, you know, that's really, for me, that's the first dimension. That's the physical dimension. And then I take a look at the second column, and it asks me, well, what did the person or institution in the first column do to make you angry? And then the more and more I wrote inventory, not really what they did. It's what I think they did. And I began to see that the second column is directly connected with the mind, with the mental dimension. And then the third column deals with emotions. Affects my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions, my personal relationships, my sex relations, my pride. And that's my emotional nature. Our book talks about that we couldn't control our emotional natures. Someone would, I think, make me angry, and I've since learned that no one can make me angry. And it's that whole 10th-step spiritual axiom thing. And then a speaker that him and I really like to listen to, he says, you know, it's like we've always been on autopilot. You go up to a jukebox, you press B5, and the song for B5 plays. And there was no separation in between the thought and the emotion. And that's starting to happen now. And I found out that the third column deals with my emotions. And then for the first time I got in touch, and this may seem strange since God is mentioned in the third step and the higher power is mentioned in the second step, but I really got in touch with this thing we call truth or this thing we call God in the fourth column of resentment inventory in my fourth step. Because for the first time, I was able to see what I did. What did I do to get the ball rolling? How did I cause it? And what I began to see was that for the first time, I saw truth. It's not about the other person. How I feel internally is not dependent on what you do or what you don't do. It's dependent on me. And I like to call that the spiritual column. I like to call that the spiritual dimension, the world of the spirit. And it was there that I really began to tap into the truth, I really began to tap into God, and I really began to tap into power. And the thing that's really great about the fourth step is that, at least having gone through the steps a few times, you get to use prayer and meditation in the fourth step. And I think it's really something that's not talked about a lot. In between the third and fourth column, there are spiritual exercises in our book. And it tells us that we need to be saying certain prayers. And we can do this in a meditative sort of way. I'm convinced today when I'm not attached to the mind, that I am not my mind. When I'm not attached to my body, I'm not my body. When I'm not attached to my emotions, I'm not my emotions. What I am goes much more deeper than that. That doesn't mean that we should treat our bodies like garbage. A friend of ours says that, you know, we've been given this spacesuit, so we need to take care of it. You know, we've always felt like aliens our whole lives, so we might as well be wearing spacesuits. You know, so it just so happens that in this lifetime, we've been given this body, and it's something that we need to take care of. But when I die, when I leave this body, it's not going to be mine anymore. It's going to either be put in a box, buried underground, or put in what is it, incinerator? It's going to be burned to ashes. It's not mine anymore. Goes back to where it came from. My thoughts are not my own. My thoughts are usually from years and years of programming from either my early teachers or society or my parents. I would say 95% of the thoughts I have today are not my own. They come from old programming, imprinting. You know, it's like I was listening to a fifth step one day and I was trying to go a little bit deeper with this person because it just seemed the right thing to do and he was getting it. And it just occurred to me that to do what I'm about to say. I don't know if you guys have pets, but my pets listen to a lot of fifth steps. And they've never once broken a confidence.
That explains the tongue sticking out.
You'd have to know our dog, Gizmo. Yeah, he probably looks the way he looks from all the footsteps he's heard. But it just occurred to me one day to, just out of the blue, in front of this person whose fifth step I was listening to, Gizmo was just kind of standing, and I said, "Sit!" And he sat. And I said, "See, that's what we're like. We're programmed. Someone tells us to sit, we sit. Someone tells us, you're not supposed to feel that way, we're not supposed to feel that way. You're not allowed to cry, we don't cry. Or we stuff it. Or we think it's a bad thing." Instead of just being who and what we are, which are spiritual beings having a human experience. None of it's good or bad, it just is.
Some of the stuff that we were just talking about, the one statement that finally hit me in regard to this was certain religions believe that if you do certain things and believe certain things, that when you die, your soul goes to heaven. So your soul goes to heaven and your body goes into the grave. And what this gentleman asked one time was, you know, you do those things, you believe those things, and so then you die, and your body goes into a box into the ground, and your soul goes to heaven. So where do you go? And when I pondered that, that was when the inner essence of my nature finally hit me. And that was when I finally saw what is today my truth about all of that, about who I really am. And that was why when I began, I said that people call me Bill. I am a child of God. And my body has alcoholism, because that is my truth. I am not my body. And that statement in and of itself, as a matter of fact, I was going to use that as an exercise between one of the sessions for everybody was, you know, here's a question to ponder while you're on break, you know. You know, if when you die, your body goes into a box, into the ground, and your soul goes to heaven. So where do you go? Maybe you want to think about that. Mike had mentioned step four. We had done a New Year's Day big book study kind of a thing, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I was talking about the transformative power of step four. I had never used that expression before, so I don't know where it came from, but since then I've been using that expression a lot. And what's interesting is that recently I've been coming upon, and people have been sort of attracted to me, and I've been working with people who have had surface experiences with going through all of the steps and not really getting a lot out of it. And in talking about the transformative power of step four, there were a lot of things, like Mike had said, that got go on between column three and column four that they weren't doing and that they didn't do and that they weren't seeing. And there were certain things that people that were listening to their fifth steps weren't pointing out that for me are really powerful in regard to four steps and fifth steps. And some of those things I just wanted to talk about for a minute, because it's kind of interesting how when you use things a lot, you start seeing the deeper and deeper levels of it, and all of a sudden there's just so much more meaning. It's just like all our literature, you know, that we read something in the big book or read something in a piece of literature, and we've read it 10, 15 times, and all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, that wasn't there before. You know what I mean? Like, who added that? You know what I mean? Somebody came into my book and added something. I'd never seen that before. And it's just that, you know, we've reached a certain different level in our life, and all of a sudden we're looking at the book from a different angle than we were before that. And we have experiences between the last time that we read it and now, and all of a sudden, now, because of a current experience, I'm seeing something totally different that I had never seen before. And that's what's been my experience in doing a lot of four steps and taking lots of people through fourth and fifth steps. And we kind of briefly mentioned something, I think Mike might have mentioned it, about mirroring, and that people are just being a mirror for us. And I can't tell you, there are the two things that I always try to draw out of fifth steps. The first one is that I'd say 99% of every resentment I've ever heard and that I ever had can be boiled down to one simple statement. They are not acting the way I want them to. And what greater form of playing God could there be than that? What greater form of self-centeredness could there be than that statement? For me, that was very powerful and that was very transformative, because in working with step 10 and 11 and using the tools of four and bringing it into 10 and 11 and making it into a way of life, that statement has brought me a lot of peace. Because as soon as I sense that resentment boiling up inside of me, if I can step back and use the tool of step four to see what really is going on here and what is my part in this, that within seconds I can be rid of this, and all of a sudden I just don't have the resentment anymore. Within seconds, sometimes. Sometimes it takes a little while. Sometimes people have to point it out to me. But for me, that is an incredible tool in seeing my self-centeredness, that most often my resentments come down to they're not acting the way I want them to. And with the mirroring thing, I can't tell you how many times I've seen a light go on in somebody's head. You listen to a fifth step and they share a whole bunch of stuff. And then you say to them, you know, you've mentioned four or five times that somebody ratted on you and you really have a problem with that. That seems to be a button that you have. And people are put. And I said to them, have you ever ratted out on anybody? And they were like, well, yeah. You know, what they were seeing was something they don't like about themselves and something in somebody else. That somebody is just being a mirror for us. And we're seeing in someone else something that we don't like about ourselves. It has nothing to do with them. And the interesting thing is, this kind of stuff ends marriages, because all of a sudden we got problems with our spouse and it doesn't even have anything to do with them. They're just, you know, I've heard people say that close relationships is the way that God sandpapers our rough edges. And that it has nothing to do with them at all. Yet, of course, it can't be us, so it has to be them, because there's only two people involved, so it has to be them. You know, it's the them theory again. You know what I mean? And for me, mirroring has been really important, because again, almost all resentments that I've ever had, especially the reoccurring ones, can totally be classified as, you know what, I'm again seeing in somebody else something I don't like about myself. And the cool thing is that I'm then given an opportunity to work on something within me that I don't like about myself. And in working on that, then all of a sudden, I don't see it all around me anymore, because it's not an issue for me anymore. And, you know, sometimes it pops up, but generally I'm just not seeing it in everybody anymore, because I'm not seeing it in myself so much anymore. And for me, that's a real freedom. And that's, again, what was mentioned before about it being an inside job. Something that isn't always noticed about the resentment, the fear, and the harms inventory is that it talks about in the 12 of 12 that we have three basic instincts. And it talks about how the three basic instincts are the social instinct, the security instinct, and the sex instinct. And that the way that the social instinct is used incorrectly and selfishly brings about resentments. And the way the security instinct is used selfishly and incorrectly brings about fears. And the way the sex instinct is used selfishly and incorrectly brings about harms. And that coincidentally, the big book inventory talks about resentment, fear, and harms. And that this isn't some surface technique that's kind of random or just kind of surface. These get down to the core of us. This gets down. The fifth step doesn't talk about we admit our wrongs. It says we admit the exact nature of our wrongs. That this isn't about sort of a confession where we just admit what we did wrong, because we haven't learned anything new yet. We always knew what we did. Confessing it, that's part of the fifth step, is getting certain things off our back that we wanted to keep and that we didn't want anybody to know about. But the deeper transformative essence of a fifth step is that we need to find out the exact nature of our wrongs. Because if I can find out why I'm doing these things, those are the shortcomings I'm then going to bring to my higher power in 6 and 7. I already have a list of harms that I can get rid of the guilt and remorse by doing 8 and 9, and now I'm back in the moment, free. Just here and now, just free and totally comfortable. It's kind of interesting with the way the fourth step is. Another thing that I've often seen and think is rather interesting, and that I've seen throughout spiritual literature, is that there really are only two emotions. There are only the root of all negative emotions is fear, and the root of all positive emotions is love. And that all resentment, all anger, and all rage comes from fear. And what's interesting about that tool as a way of life as we go through our day is that when I'm starting to get angry with people, instead of looking at the anger and saying, you know, how can I deal with this, or let me look at the anger, if I can look a little bit deeper in that and say, wait a minute, what is the fear here? And then look at the fear and deal with the fear, that all of a sudden the resentment and the anger just goes away, because I've dealt with the root of the issue. I haven't dealt with the surface, the you know, the outer part of it. I've dealt with the inner part of it, and then that resentment just goes away. Again, an incredible tool to be free of certain things as I go through my day, that moments later I can just be free of it. And again, sometimes I can see it, and sometimes I need to talk to somebody else, and maybe they can see it. And then, like Mike had said, between the third and fourth column, there's an incredible tool between the third and fourth column. I've actually recently, it's been happening more recently, but I did hear about it all along, and I've seen on some websites that some people actually see the resentment inventory as just three columns, and it's that example that's given in how it works. Just that one page that has the three columns, and there's nothing more to the fourth step. Now, I always knew who I was pissed at. I always knew why I was mad at them, and I always knew how it affected me. So if the resentment inventory is three columns, I haven't learned anything new. But when it introduces the fourth column, two pages later, the book actually from the third column to the fourth column takes a two-page break so that we can soften our heart toward these people and these places and these things. So that we can get a... It's funny because those two pages talk about this one word but never mention that one word. And it's kind of strange because, again, you know, it's interesting how certain people can pass along experience with pages in the book that you won't see. You could read it forever and you won't necessarily catch it. And that word is forgiveness. That there needs to be a softening of our heart and a sense of forgiveness toward these people, places, and things before we get to the fourth column. And it talks about that, you know, perhaps these people are spiritually sick. And I don't like that term spiritually sick because I believe that spiritually we are perfect. But I use the term spiritually blocked or spiritually ignorant. And that they, like ourselves, were spiritually blocked. That when I harm somebody, in that moment I am spiritually blocked. I am not tapped into that good voice that's within me. When somebody else hurts me or anybody else, every harm that's ever been done occurred because at that moment they were spiritually blocked and that they were spiritually unconscious. And that's why, again, when the spiritual malady is overcome, when we awaken to the awareness of that part within us that is of God, that is our essence, that is the good voice, or whatever you want to call it, your conscience, whatever, that we then are able to be in the moment doing the next right thing. And it's almost a no-brainer. But then that other voice keeps coming back. You know, it never goes away, but it gets weaker and weaker the less we feed it. The fear inventory is kind of interesting because I've seen two-column fear inventories. I've seen four-column fear inventories, which is actually something that I use. I've seen three-column fear inventories. I've seen people say there is no fear inventory. Now, what's interesting about that statement is that since fear is the ego root, that if there is no fear inventory, I'd like to suggest that that's a very surface pass through the fourth step. There needs to be a fear inventory involved because for me, the fear is the root of all of it. What's interesting is that the example that has three columns and then how it works, every single resentment has the word fear next to it, and I don't think that's a coincidence. The fear inventory that I see in the big book is that the first column is, you know, I list my fears. I ask myself why I have them. Then it says, you know, did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? You know, what's our part in this? What am I doing to contribute to the fear is basically how I see the third column. And I also tie in the beginning of how it works, it talks about that selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our trouble. So I kind of tie in, you know, was I selfish or self-seeking in regard to this? How am I contributing to the fear? And that's the third column. And then the fourth column kind of came out of meditation, and it kind of came out of a strange comment that was answered while laying in bed. I was reading the part of the fear inventory that says, you know, perhaps there is a better way. For now, we're trying to rely upon God more, and it kind of talks about the third step a little bit. And I was laying in bed, and I kept thinking, you know, there seems to be a fourth column here, but I'm not necessarily seeing it. And I said something to my wife, who I was laying in bed with, and she said, well, maybe what the fourth column is what perhaps is a better way. You know, because it says perhaps there is a better way. So what perhaps is a better way? And that was when it hit me that for me that is the fourth column, that, yeah, it's real good to identify that I have fear. Yeah, it's real good to ask God to help me with that. But God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but he won't do for me what I can do for myself. And that fourth column of what perhaps is a better way, and then later on it says, you know, we ask God to, you know, what would he have us be? That last column is, you know, what perhaps is a better way, and what would God have us be in this, you know, in regard to this fear? That God will help me on the inside, but I needed to be doing certain things also to move away from that fear. And a really good example is that I came into AA having an extreme fear of public speaking. And today I have an extreme love of public speaking. I experience no fear when I am up here in front of people. And you can't get there from here the way I came in. I had an extreme fear of public speaking when I came in. And in regard to what perhaps is a better way, not only can I ask God to help me with it, I can perhaps take some public speaking classes. I can perhaps volunteer to do readings at meetings because, I mean, we have a built-in public speaking class as far as I'm concerned in regard to AA. I mean, we get so many opportunities to do public speaking. And also, I could ask other people, how did you, you know, how did you help? How did you get over your fear of public speaking? What do you do to move through that? So there's like, for me, that last column, you know, the first three columns identify sort of, you know, okay, I have these fears. Yeah, I contribute toward them, but what perhaps is a better way of moving away from them? And then, you know, like a year from now, if I'm still experiencing some of those fears that I had just inventoried a year earlier, I need to come back to that list and say, well, what am I not doing to move away from it? Because I sort of have a plan here to move the outdoor, the exit door away from these fears, and also helping, asking God to help me with it. So for me, you know, in regard to 10 and 11, and I don't think we necessarily touched upon it, but, you know, the beginning part of step 10 talks about steps 4 through 9 on a really quick basis, and step 11 talks about 4 through 9 on a really quick basis as well. That as part of the moment-by-moment daily inventory, it talks about continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That was exactly what we did in the fourth step. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. That's talking about steps 6 and 7. It says we discuss them with someone immediately, which is like step 5, and make amends quickly when we have harmed anyone. That's steps 8 and 9. And then in step 11, it touches upon the same thing when we do our evening review. It says, where was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, and afraid, which is what we did in 4. Do I owe an apology? That's like 8 and 9. Have I kept something to myself that should be discussed with another person at once? That's like 5. And then at the end of that paragraph, it talks about, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken, which is like 6 and 7. So it's interesting how the process of the middle steps and the reworking of the middle steps is a major aspect of this step 10 and 11 / AA program way of life. As a tool, moment by moment, to get through it. The fourth step is not just a tool to deal with the past. The fourth step is also a tool that when this stuff comes up in the future, I can now step back, pause when agitated or doubtful, see what's my part in this, what's really going on here, maybe talk to somebody about it, get some freedom. Moments later, I'm back on the beam again. Moments later, I am not accumulating through life, letting this stuff pile up. And then at the end of the day, I'm spitting bullets. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, once I have three or four of these things happen in my life, the next person that comes along is just going to get the brunt of my disappointments and my anger. You know, it's strange because that was something that the guy said when I had gone on that retreat. He said that, you know, it's kind of interesting because we generally go through life, and when good things happen to us, you know, like peace and compassion and, you know, success or whatever, very often we keep that to ourselves. But when bad things happen to us, like disappointments and fear and, you know, resentment, that why is it that we spread that around? You know, why is it that we spread that and give that to the people that are around us? And what he had said was, you know, the spiritual way of life is reversing that. Is that when good things are happening to us, talk about that and take that out on the people that are around us. And that when bad things are happening to us, we have tools to deal with it, and we have ways to at times to not even let it leave us. That we can deal with it immediately, and then we don't have to worry about when we come home, all of a sudden we're spitting bullets and you know, it's already gone too far. We're already into rage and resentment and anger, and you know, we can deal with it when we are just agitated and have tools as we go through life. It's not, the fourth step is not just about dealing with the past. It's to develop, to deal with the past and also to develop tools as this stuff goes along, moment by moment, as we go through the day.
If you care to practice an exercise between now and the next session we meet up at, which will be 9 o'clock this evening, that'll be our final session for today, and then we'll have one more tomorrow morning. By the way, the 9 o'clock session tonight, as far as we can tell, unless God has other ideas, will entirely be on acceptance. Which I know everyone's going to race to that one because that's a topic that alcoholics just love. But an exercise that you can do is to meditate and maybe making it a walking, moment-by-moment, living, breathing meditation. It's not something you have to do sitting in the silence, but just let it radiate your consciousness as we have dinner this evening. You can speak if you care to during dinner. Doesn't have to be silent. There's a 7:30 speaker meeting here. And then a half hour after that's done, we'll meet up again. So here's the exercise. or it's not even an exercise, it's just a ponderance. There is only one place, and there is only one time. That place is here, that time is now. Here now. It's a new word. There's a dash in the middle. Here now. There is only one place, and there is only one time. Here now. We'll see y'all tonight.